right, so we're in Leviticus 24. So does anyone remember Leviticus 23, what that was all about?
Don't tell me any of that. Don't let me. 16 and 23, the rest I don't know anything. Just for those two, I don't.
Okay, well, that's good. 16 and 23, they're good chapters to know. All right, what about the feasts? Do you need it open, Abby?
Oh, my
okay.
Sorry.
No.
Not understanding her.
She's not giving you her snack, trust me. God, nice. So what about, can someone tell me something about the feasts?
They're sort of the calendar.
Okay.
The
yes.
For the year.
Year.
Or the year.
Yep. Anything else?
There's like seven of them.
Yes. And what else about seven?
Yeah.
It is.
Sorry. That's okay.
Yep, it's the number of completion.
Creation.
Creation.
I have the note, God, your time is God's time. And there's no moment in your life that isn't holy, God tells us.
That's right. That's right. So the calendar was to remind Israel that they're not even in charge of their own time, right? They got to do things God's way and celebrate not when they want to, but when God wants them to. Good. Okay. So we had our different feasts, starting with Sabbath. Remember, that was the very first feast mentioned, was Sabbath, which is important, going to be important for today. Okay. So we had Sabbath, and then we had Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits, which Kyle mentioned on Sunday, right, that Jesus rose. Are you all right, sweetie? On the 16th of Nisan, which would have been first fruits, okay? And he was the first fruit from the dead. Okay, and remember, if you remember, the 14th, 15th, and 16th of Nisan were all celebratory days. The 14th was Passover, 15th was first day of unleavened bread, and 16th was first fruits.
Wasn't unleavened bread a whole week long thing?
Yes, it was. But I'm saying the 15th was the first day, and it was a Sabbath-like day. Okay, so Passover, you celebrated Passover at sunset or whatever, and Kyle, the whole controversy on Sunday, okay? And then the 15th was supposed to be a Sabbath-like day, and then the 16th, you would have brought your first fruits to offer, okay? Then you have three feasts on Day of, well, then 50 days later, you have Pentecost, and then in the seventh month, you have three feasts, the Rosh Hashanah, New Year, or Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and then Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. Okay. Okay, so then we get chapter 24. And chapter 24 is an odd chapter because 23 is all about the feasts, and then 25 is about the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee, which go right along with the feasts, right? The feasts are your yearly calendar, and then God is saying every seventh year and every 50th year you're supposed to do something extra special, right? So those fit right along with chapter 23, but the thing is you have chapter 24 in the middle, okay? And chapter 24 is about always provide oil for the lamps. You got to change out the bread on the table of showbread every Sabbath, and you have a half Egyptian, half Israeli that blasphemes God. So you're kind of like, oh, okay, why'd you put this in here, Moses? Like, why here? I mean, fine, if you want to record it, whatever. So my commentaries basically had no explanation. That's right. But why did God tell him to? Why is this chapter here? Okay. Both my commentaries basically didn't have an answer. They just said, that maybe it's like you're supposed to worship all year, God all year long, and now you're supposed to also worship God all week, and then, okay, now we have Jubilee and Sabbath, okay? So, but I'm reading another book, and I didn't fully understand his argument, so if you guys don't understand, I'm sorry if I don't communicate it correctly. He says that chapter 24, the picture is supposed to be of the perfect Sabbath. Okay, so this is what we're going to try to build. That the menorah, the light, represents God, okay? The table of showbread represents Israel, Okay, the light shines on Israel. Israel basking in God's life is the light, is the perfect Sabbath. And the Sabbath theme runs through, because chapter 23, the very first feast is the Sabbath, right, which is weekly. Okay, then chapter 25, it's all about Sabbath, right? It's a Sabbath year every seventh years. And then on the 50th year, it's like an extra Sabbath year, okay, extra special year. Okay, so the theme of Sabbath definitely runs through it all. Okay, so that he says, this cultic drama, I propose, symbolizes the ideal Sabbath, the 12 tribes of Israel basking in the divine light, being renewed in God's presence Sabbath by Sabbath. Okay, because remember, God is dwelling with man. Point of the tent of meeting was that man could now come and commune with God, albeit through all this cultic ceremony, right? And Aaron was only allowed in the Holy of Holies once a year. But the idea is that God is dwelling with man. They get to commune with holy God, and this is how they do it. And so the picture of the lampstand and the bread is the ideal perfect Sabbath, which, remember, all the way back from Genesis, right? After chapter 3, we are trying to get back to Sabbath rest, because that's how it was supposed to be. That is the ideal. Okay? And we lost it in Genesis 3. Okay? It's every Sabbath year, but we will get there in chapter 25. Okay? We'll talk more about it in chapter 25. Yes? Just God, God's presence, God's light. Okay?
And what was right after that?
And then the bread represents Israel.
Oh, thank
you. Yep. Okay, and we'll get there too. So can someone read for me Exodus 24, verses 1 through 9?
The Lord spoke to Moses, command the Israelites to bring you pure oil from crushed olives for the light, in order to keep the lamp burning continually. Aaron is to tend to it continually, but remain for morning before the Lord in two rows, six to a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. Place pure frankincense near each row so that it may serve as a memorial portion for the bread and a fire offering to the Lord. The bread is to be set out before the Lord every Sabbath day as a perpetual covenant obligation on the part of the Israelites. It belongs to Aaron and his sons, who are to eat it in a holy place, for it is the holiest portion for him from the fire offering to the Lord. This is
okay, so verses 1 through 4 is all about the lampstand or the menorah, and verses 5 through 9 is all about the table of showbread or the bread. Okay, so Leviticus 1 through 4, 24, 1 through 4 repeats the instructions that were given in Exodus 27, verse 20 and 21. This should be familiar, that Israel was to provide the oil. Okay, 20 through 21. Okay, so they are to provide the oil, verse 2, so that the lamp can burn continually. Remember, the lampstand was not to go out. Now, I have to assume that when they packed up tabernacle and moved, that then the lights would go out. But when tabernacle was set up, the lights were to be burning day and night. So that meant Aaron had to attend to these lights morning and evening, right? In evening, he had to make sure that there was enough oil, whatever, so that it would burn through till morning. Okay, it says, verse 3, that the menorah is outside the veil of testimony. Okay, testimony refers to the Ten Commandments, which were kept in the Ark of the Covenant. So the lampstand is in the holy place, right, outside the veil that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. Okay, so let's go to Exodus 25. Can someone read for me Exodus 25, verse 37? Exodus 25, 37.
Then they shall make its lamps seven in number, and they shall mount its lamps so as to shine. shed light on the space in front of it.
Okay. Now, Numbers 8, 1 through 4 says basically the same thing, that the lamps were to be positioned in such a way that it shed light in front of it. Not above it, not behind it, but in front of it. Okay. Does anyone remember their tabernacle furniture arrangement? Okay. We had the tabernacle, right? Okay, here was the Holy of Holies, right? And you had the Ark of the Covenant here. Okay, do you remember what was here?
Incense.
Okay, and then here was the menorah. And what was over here? Showbread. So the lamps, twice it says, here in Exodus 25:37, and then in Numbers 8, 1 through 4, it specifically says that the lamps were to be positioned in such a way that it shone light in front of it. Well, what's in front of it? No, in front of it, the showbread, right? So the lantern, the lamps were to shine their light specifically on the table of showbread, okay? Just from the way that this is set up, okay? I don't know if you remember this from Exodus, but when we were studying the menorah, the lampstand, do you remember it's the word for lamps or lights is the same word as used where? Do we remember? What? No. Good guess. Okay, it's in Genesis 1:14. Can someone read for me Genesis 1:14? Okay, that word for lights in the Hebrew, it's like lamps. Okay, it's the same word that is used for the menorah. So in Exodus 25, which I should have stayed there, 25. When it says, then you shall make its lamps, seven in number, it's the same word. Okay, so when God created the world, when he places the stars and the moon and the sun in the skies, they're lamps in the skies. And that word is not used very often. And most of the time it is used to talk about the menorah. Okay, those lamps. So when we study the menorah, we drew the correlation between the menorah and the lights in the heavens. And if you remember, these lights in the heavens are for seasons, days, and signs, seasons, days, and years. And many commentaries say the better translation would be not for like seasons, but for festivities, for basically the Jewish calendar, okay, for festivals to the Lord, okay? So it's the same word for light, lamps, as it is using for the menorah. Okay, so the menorah, so you draw that correlation, and this chapter makes at least a little more sense because we're talking about the festivals. Okay, also the menorah has seven branches, and it's to be attended to daily, every day, right? We're going to then talk about showbread, which is tended to how often?
Once a week.
Okay, so again, we have creation every day versus once a week Sabbath. Okay. That's true. Only if God allowed it.
They ate it at the end of the week.
And it's pretty dry. And it was, they're pretty sure it was unleavened. So it's more like a ginormous cracker is what it is. Well, yeah, we're going to talk about that because our translation says two-tenths of an ephah. And we're like, oh, what does that mean? Yours said 4 quarts, which is what it is. One loaf, 4 quarts of flour. That's a lot of flour. So, okay, so again, the whole calendar centers around the number seven and Sabbath. And we talked about that last week, right? How even during your feasts, you have Sabbath-like days, days where you were not supposed to work. Okay? So, that's the lampstand. We have a daily rhythm. Moses. Aaron is tending to it every single day, making sure that it's kept lit, and the people were then to provide the oil. Then, verse 5 to 9, we talk about showbread, the table of showbread, okay? So we have 12 loaves of bread, which symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel, okay? Each loaf was 4 quarts of flour, so they're massive rows. Now, our translation says, verse 6, you shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row, okay? But that word for row literally just means arrangement, okay? So Josephus says they were stacked on top of each other, maybe in 2 piles, okay? They're arranged in 2 piles. I mean, they're massive, so that's probably the only way they're going to fit on the table of showbread, because if you just lay them all out, it's going to be too big, okay? Then, okay, so you have your bread, and then you have the frankincense on top of it. But notice it says, verse 7, you shall put pure frankincense on each row that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, even an offering by fire to the Lord, okay? Well, we know they didn't burn the bread, okay? Because Aaron and his sons got to eat it at the end of the week. So what was burned was the frankincense, the incense on top of it, and I'm sure they had it in something so it didn't like burn on top of the bread. Okay. Memorial portion, that is also used of the grain offering. If you remember when you bought a grain offering to the Lord, they would take if it was raw, they would take a handful of it and burn that, and that was the memorial portion to the Lord. Okay, so for this bread, it is the frankincense that is burned, the incense that's burned, that's the memorial portion to the Lord. Do you have a question? Okay. Okay, and then every Sabbath, the bread was to be changed. Verse 8, every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant. Okay, Josephus, does everyone know who Josephus is? No, that's okay. Josephus was a Jewish historian living during the time of Christ, right after, but I believe his life overlapped Christ's life. And he wrote about Christ. So that's why we refer to Josephus a lot, because he wrote down the history of the day from a Jewish perspective, but it's an extra biblical source that we have that talks about Jesus, okay? And he wrote all about Jewish customs and everything like that too. And I believe he wrote for the Romans, like the Romans hired him to write history or whatever. But he is a secular, not Christian historian that wrote about Christ and what Jewish life was like during the time. So that's why we say when Josephus says they were piled or whatever, you know, he's writing about what they actually did. And so it's just another source for us. Okay. So he says that the bread was baked the day before the Sabbath and was unleavened. Okay. So then because you're not supposed to cook on Sabbath. You're supposed to rest, but so on Sabbath, Aaron would have taken the loaves that had already been prepared and he would replace them. And then verse 9, it says, it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place. So they got to eat the old bread. The ones from the week before they got to eat, and then there's the new bread that sat there for the next week. Okay? So this replacing of the bread every day, every Sabbath is called an everlasting covenant, which is interesting because everlasting covenants are not frequently used in the Old Testament, that this phrase, okay? It's used of the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the New Covenant, and also the covenant of the Sabbath when it says in Exodus 31, that Sabbath is to be a perpetual covenant, right? It's the same everlasting covenant. Okay, so this is, when I was studying this, I'm like, that seems to me to make this a bigger deal than people talk about, right? Because, yes, is this covenant going to be on the same level as the Davidic covenant, right? No, probably not. However, God chose to use the same language to talk about the replacing of the bread every week as he did to talk about the Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant. So I was a little frustrated because I couldn't find a lot about it. But This is the only offering that is referred to as an everlasting covenant. And the bread symbolizes the relationship between Yahweh and Israel. Okay? There also may be a link back to Exodus 16 with the manna that stays fresh on Sabbath day. Right? Because they had to gather enough on Friday, and then it wouldn't rot on Saturday. If they gathered more than they should any other day, it would have rotted. But God preserved the bread, right, for Sabbath day. And here now we have a constant. Every Sabbath, the bread is replenished. Okay? Probably to remind Israel that God is the one that provides.
Sorry.
That's okay.
This truck just kept backing up and up and up, and it's like, I thought there was going to stop.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Numbers. Okay, can someone read for me Numbers 6, verse 23 to 27?
Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them.
Okay, so my one book said that this, the picture of the menorah shining on the table of showbread, is a picture of this blessing, that God's face is shining on Israel. Okay, and every Sabbath there is now this ritual to change out the bread and to remind them that God's face is shining on them. Okay, so verses 1 through 9, this presents the ideal of Israel paused in worship before Yahweh. This is what Sabbath was to be like, communion with God. Okay, the calendar was to bring a Sabbath feel to the entire year and a constant reminder of the covenant that the Sabbath signifies. Okay, because remember, all the feasts had at least one day or more that were Sabbath-like days where they were not supposed to work. Okay, so it was to be a constant reminder that God is in charge and I am to be in communion with God. And this picture here of the menorah and the showbread is to be a picture of Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. After seeing pictures of it, mm-hmm, during our study, how did they make the light go straight ahead and not out to the sides or to the back?
I have no idea. I don't know, because, okay, they had cups, right? All the little stands had cups, and maybe you could, I think what I've seen is they would have cups, and then in the cups they would place the lanterns, right? And the lantern would be a clay, most likely, bowl with oil in it and a wick, right, to burn. So I don't know if you could somehow create those bowls and position them in the cups so that they would shine the light forward. I don't know. That is just an off the top of my head guess. So take it as you will.
I'm wondering, you could place it this way, or you could place it this way.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that's more of a specific. It was.
Yeah, maybe the wick is supposed to be placed a specific direction so that the light goes more one direction. I don't know. We don't have lanterns like that. And I'm sure they didn't give off too much light either, would be my guess. But
well, it was gold, though, on the inside.
Right. So, so it would have reflected. Yeah. But still.
To get across, to shine onto the table of showbread, I know it wasn't a huge room.
Right.
Probably, what is it, 15 feet or something?
Something like that. I don't remember.
Don't
something like that. Yes, that is close. Right. Now, there are seven of them, and you're right, there is gold, which is reflective, but yeah. Oh, it doesn't say. I don't remember. I thought my little diagram in here would say the dimensions, but it doesn't. But I think 15 feet is a pretty close guess. So, good. Questions? Okay, can someone read for me verse 10 to 23 of chapter 24?
Struggled with each other in the camp. And the son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name and cursed. So they brought him to Moses. Now his mother's name was Shelomith, and the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of Dan. And they put him in custody so that the command of the Lord might be made clear. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the one who is cursed outside the camp, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head, and let all the congregation stone him. And you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if anyone curses his God, then he shall bear his sin. Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him. The alien as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall he be put to death. And if the man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. And the one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. And if a man injures his neighbors, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as for the native, for I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the sons of Israel, and they brought the one who had cursed outside the camp and stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did, just as the Lord had commanded Moses.
Okay, so to make this chapter even more odd, right, you get this random story about the blasphemer, okay? So commentators believe that possibly this event happened shortly after Moses had received these specific laws, okay? And so then that's why it's here, that Leviticus truly is a narrative and it's recorded in the order God revealed it. So that's one possibility. But also you have to remember that the focus of the second half of Leviticus, so after chapter 16, right? So we have sacrifices, then we have chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu, which then we have the unclean laws, and then we have Day of Atonement, and then we have the Holiness Code, which all stem right from Nadab and Abihu, because after that, Aaron was told you need to differentiate between clean and unclean, holy and profane. Okay, so before Day of Atonement, we get clean and unclean. After Day of Atonement, we get holy and profane. Okay, so Israel was to be a holy nation. They were to be a kingdom of priests. And all of that, right, is to accurately reflect the name of God to the nations. Okay, remember, the name of God is not just his title. It is his essence, who he is. That's what the book of Exodus is about. It's revealing the essence of God. Okay? Now, Leviticus, we're like, how do we approach this essence of God? Well, part of it is we are to be a holy nation, and we are to reflect to the nations of the world who the true God really is. Okay? So this story is a small example of what happens when you fail. Okay, of when you speak against the name of God, the essence of God, who he truly is. Okay, and what should be done to the individual who does this, but this kind of happens to Israel as a whole, right, when they fail God because they don't obey. And God then, I mean, he doesn't stone them, right, but they get sent into exile and many of them die. So we have this half Egyptian, half Israeli, is Jewish man, okay? Now, his father was Egyptian, and you typically identified with your father, so this could be viewed as a Gentile living in the nation, okay? And remember, when they came out of Egypt, they came out a mixed multitude, so it wasn't just the Jews that came out, okay? So he has some sort of fight with a fully Jewish man, and he, verse 11, the son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name and cursed. Okay, so this would have been the name Yahweh. And it's actually from this verse that the Jewish avoidance of uttering God's name came from. Okay, if you know the Jews, they will not say God's name. If they see Yahweh, they will say, I believe it's Adonai, I believe, right? Okay, they change the vowel. Okay. Do we know how Hebrew works? Hebrew, when you write Hebrew, you only write the consonants. You don't write the vowels. Okay? So you can have the same set of consonants with different vowels, and it would be said two different ways. Abigail, no. So they take the name Yahweh and they add different vowels to make, they take the consonants and add different vowels so that they can say the name without saying the name. Okay. So when you have, when you're learning Hebrew, like today, you would have vowel markings on the word so you would know which vowels they are. But if you're really good at Hebrew and you write, you know, if you read the Old Testament, there are no, it, in the original, there are no vowel markings. It's just the consonants and you just have to know them. Okay, so you have to know the language well enough that you just know what the word is. Okay, so it is from this verse that the Jews took and they said, well, we don't want to even be at risk at ever blaspheming the name of God, so we're just not going to say his name ever. Okay, it kind of misses the point. Okay, you can blaspheme the name of God without specifically mentioning God's proper name, Yahweh. Okay, but that's where this comes from. So it's possible that we're not exactly sure what the Egyptian did. Okay, it's possible that he used the name of God in a curse, cursing the, I would assume, the other man he was fighting with. But we don't know exactly what he said or exactly what he did because it doesn't say. Okay, Israel seems a little unsure of what to do. Because it says, verse 12, they put him in custody so that the command of the Lord might be made clear to them. So they're like, oh, you did something bad. We're not sure what to do with you, so we'll ask God. And in the meantime, you stay locked up. Okay, so they're waiting on God. Verse 13 through 16, it is God himself who hands down the judgment. So he tells Moses exactly what they are supposed to do. Okay, so the first thing that had to happen, well, they go outside the camp. Right, because he's going to die. And if you remember, dead bodies make you unclean. Okay, so you don't want to make the inside of the camp unclean, so you go outside the camp. All right. And then, second, all who heard him have to lay their hands on his head. This is kind of reminiscent of the scapegoat, or really any sacrifice, right? A transference of sin. And so because of that, my commentators both said that there is even some guilt in hearing someone else blaspheme God. And so you now have to transfer your guilt onto him, and then he will die for your guilt, which really was, he was the cause of in the first place. Okay. So, and then they stone him to death. Okay. And the idea here is that if God requires even a foreigner to be executed for this offense, he would certainly not tolerate this violation in Israel. Who were to be identified with his name, they were to be proclaimers of his name, of who he was. Okay, and if you look at verse 16, it says the alien as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. Okay, so if you were a foreigner living in Israel, you had to live under God's rules. Okay, you did not get to just say, well, I'm not part of the nation, so therefore I get to do what I want. They had to submit to God's laws as well. Carried out?
No, mentioned before. Like they had in previous.
Oh, you mean in Exodus?
Yeah, you know they had the, you know, stoning and manslaughter.
Yep.
Premeditated murder.
Yep.
And all those other things.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was blaspheming.
I don't remember either. Yeah, I don't know. I think, actually, here, let me just see what this verse. No, I don't think so. But I don't know. I don't know for sure. I don't remember. Okay. That's a good question. If this is the first time.
If you think of it, I mean, all those other things are, you know, like,
yeah.
All those are important in general, but in the context of this, we just got off a feast and we talked about this whole big Sabbath thing.
Right.
You know, it makes sense that, you know, this is the big, you know, people wouldn't
right.
necessarily the big.
Right.
This is the big.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, God
yes.
is paramount to
murder. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as bad or worse than anything.
Right, right. Yes. And I think I had mentioned before that in other nations, the biggest punishment were reserved for harming someone's stuff. So like a financial loss to someone, okay? But in God's nation, in Israel, the highest punishment was reserved for religion and family or life, okay? So sinning against God, blaspheming, right? And not, right, all sin is sin against God, but specific, you know, heinous sins against God and sins against the family or life, right? Adultery, murder, those kinds of things received the highest punishment, whereas in other nations it wasn't that way. So, yeah. Okay, then we get to verse 17 to 22, which is, this is your typical eye for eye, tooth for tooth passage, okay? But the idea here is that the punishment must fit the crime, okay? Typically, this was not carried out literally, okay? So if you put someone's eye out, doesn't mean that your eye was put out, okay? The time it was carried out literally was for murder, okay? If it was premeditated murder, right? Later on, I think in Numbers or Deuteronomy, we get, probably Deuteronomy, if you accidentally killed someone, you know, you're swinging the axe and the axe head flies off and kills them, right? You could flee to a city of refuge. Okay, because it wasn't premeditated. But if it's premeditated murder, you killed someone, therefore you had to die. Okay, but typically it was some form of compensation, and we did see this in Exodus. Okay, Exodus 21:26. I don't know if you remember, but if a slave, if you are a harsh master and you beat your slave and you put out his eye, your slave is set free. Okay, which is a huge financial loss to the master. Or even if you knock out his tooth, the slave is set free. Okay, so, and then I believe when we studied Exodus 2, if you accidentally killed someone's ox, you had to give them enough money to buy a new one. It's not like he came and killed your ox. Okay, because really, that might make you feel a little better, but it doesn't replace your loss, right? So you need to give him enough money so he can buy a new ox to replace the one he lost. Okay, so the idea here is that the punishment needs to fit the crime. Okay, compensation according to the loss had to be paid. All right, verse 23, then Moses spoke to the sons of Israel, and they brought the one who had cursed outside the camp and stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Okay, so Israel obeys, and they kill the blasphemer. God is concerned about holiness and justice in the camp, Israelite camp, as well as in his tabernacle. Okay. Okay, New Testament. Do you remember who was accused of blasphemy? Jesus was. Who else? Yes, very good. So Matthew 26, 65 to 66. That's when the high priest tears his robe, right? And says blasphemy, which is so ironic because he's not supposed to tear his robe. So he is breaking the law while accusing Jesus of breaking the law, okay? And then Acts 6:11 as well. They're so angry that they accuse Stephen of blasphemy, and then what do? They carry him out and stone him, okay? After his speech, he makes them so mad, right, that they stone him. They carry out Leviticus 24 improperly, but they do, okay? Yes. Yeah, Matthew 26, 65 to 66. Jesus is accused of blasphemy. All right, questions, Leviticus 24. Okay, Leviticus 25. There are three main topics in this chapter. The first is Sabbath, rest for the land, and then year of Jubilee, which those are tied together. Second is redemption of property. Third, redemption of a slave. Okay? The main purpose of these laws is to prevent the utter ruin of debtors. Okay? If you are poor, you get into financial trouble, right? You have to sell your land. If you get so bad, you have to sell yourself. God had built into his laws protections for you. Okay? In most society, studying this, especially with what's going on in our country today, I just found it so ironic. But, okay, so in most societies, you have a few rich and many poor, right? And like in England, right? In the old days, you would have your huge landowners, and then you would have your serfs that didn't own any land, but they did all the work for you, okay? And there was no real way for them to ever work their way out of poverty, okay? But God system is set up to help prevent that, okay? These laws basically say, just to sum it up quickly, the longest you could sell yourself or your land is 49 years, okay? The longest. So approximately at least once in everyone's adult life, the slate would be wiped clean and everybody got a fresh start, okay? Approximately once in your adult life, okay? Depending on how long you live and where the year of Jubilee, okay? So this would have restored some semblance of equality to the nation, okay? So I just think it's so funny today because we're, you know, tax the rich, whatever, you know. We need to have more equality. The poor need to get better. The rich need to get poorer, whatever. But it's like, you want to try God's system? Pretty sure you don't. But I just thought it was interesting that God had a way that's not communism, but it's also not pure capitalism either, right? Now, his way only really works if you're an agrarian society, but that's what they were. And so God gave specific land to specific families, to specific tribes, and it was never to permanently leave that family or tribe. Now, what's the problem? Does anyone know? Yeah, Israel never did this. Okay, so these are rules that God sets forth of how it's supposed to be done. We are pretty sure that this never happened. Yes. Okay.
No wonder they were in.
Yes. Okay. So one of my commentators said, but as a social institution, the Jubilee year remained an ideal, which was rarely, if ever, realized. Rabbinic literature says that it was reckoned to be obsolete in post-exilic periods. Post-exilic times. So we are pretty sure that this probably never happened. Possibly you had your individuals that would have followed it, but as a nation, they did not. Okay. We don't have record of Jubilee being celebrated in the Old Testament. Okay. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 36. Can someone read for me verse 21? 2 Chronicles 36, 21.
To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath, all the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete.
Okay, so this basically is saying the reason for the length of their exile is because they didn't even celebrate the Sabbath years, which was 1 year out of every seventh year. You were supposed to not farm the land. We'll get to that. That's the first part of this chapter. Okay? Every seventh year, you were not to farm the land. They didn't even do that. Okay? So then they had to be in exile that long because the land had to catch up. Now, remember, too, they are at Sinai right now in Leviticus. These laws are for when they enter the land, which is not going to be for another 40 years. Plus, they have to conquer, you know, and they have to get settled in the land, right? And that takes time, 6 years, I believe. Okay, so these laws wouldn't even have been applicable for another 46 years.
We know that the law is repeated.
In Deuteronomy.
Because it's the new generation.
Exactly, and they need to know. But so it's going to be a long time from here, but Second Chronicles makes it sound like they don't even ever keep the Sabbath year. So if you're not even going to do that, what's the chances that you're going to keep Jubilee? Slim to none, right? What I found extremely ironic is look at chapter 26 of Leviticus. Someone read for me Leviticus 26, 34. And 35.
Then the land will make up for its Sabbath years during the time it lies desolate when you are in the land of your enemies. That time the land will rest and make up for its Sabbath. As long as it lies desolate, it will have rest and do not have during your Sabbath when you live there.
Okay. God says, yes, God says, hey, every seventh year, Sabbath year. Every 50th year. Jubilee year. Oh, by the way, you're not even going to do it anyway, so that's why you're going to go into exile. And so the land can enjoy its Sabbath. It's like 2 Chronicles 36:21 is in Leviticus. They haven't even made it into the land yet. They're not going to make it into the land for another 40 years. And God already knows. But, so basically, Leviticus 25 is God's ideal of how things should be. It never worked out this way. But this, now, portions of it did, because Leviticus 25 talks about kinsman redeemer. And we do know that that at least happened sometimes, okay? But Sabbath year and Jubilee year didn't, okay? Sorry, one more place before we even get into the chapter. Nehemiah 10. Nehemiah 10:31. Okay, remember, this is after the exile. They're building up the wall. Nehemiah 10:31. Okay, so this is Nehemiah. So it seems like his intention, at least, was when they're back in the land, they're going to observe Sabbath, not buy anything on Sabbath. So Gentile sellers, don't even bother coming by, because we're not going to buy from you, and we will not plant every seventh year. Okay, whether that actually happened or not, I'm not sure. But at least it seems like Nehemiah's intent was to observe the Sabbath year. All right, so we're not going to read all of this. I don't know that we have time. Okay, Leviticus 25, 1 to 22. So verse 1 to 7, I'll read real quick. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its crop. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. All of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, your hired man, your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you. Even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat." Okay, so just like the Sabbath is day 7 of the week, so 6 weeks, 6 days you work, 7th day you rest, the Sabbath year is year 7. 6 years you plant your fields, 7th year you don't. Okay, during that year, there's to be no organized farming, sowing, pruning, reaping. The land was just to lie fallow. You were just to let grow whatever would grow. Okay. So that's also verse 5, where it says, "Your harvest after growth you shall not reap." There was to be no, "Hey, I'm going to go out today and gather in all the grapes." Okay, you weren't to do that. Okay, but verse 6, "All of you shall have the Sabbath's product of the land for food." So you could say, "Hey, there are some grapes on that vine. I'm hungry. I'll go eat those grapes." Okay? Or, "I'm going to go get those grapes for today's lunch." Whatever. But also, you could then get the grapes from anywhere. Your neighbor's field. And your neighbor could come over into your field and get whatever. The animals could eat whatever they wanted. The people could eat whatever they wanted of what grew. What happened to grow in that seventh year. Okay, but the land was supposed to lie fallow. You were supposed to let the land rest. Okay, so you were supposed to live more like a nomad, like a hunter-gatherer type of, you know, than a planting that year. The land is God's, and he dictates how you can use it. This law would show Israel that it is God that provides for them and not their own labor. Yes, we are called to work, but whether we succeed or not, right? Whether the land produces or not, that's totally up to God. And it is God who provides. Okay? Let's go to Deuteronomy 31. Can someone read for me Deuteronomy 31, 10 to 13, please?
When all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God, at the place which he will choose. You shall read this law in front of all Israel in their hearing. Assemble the people, the men and the women and the children, and the alien who is in your town, so that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law.
Okay, so, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. So every seventh year at the Feast of Booths, so this would have been in the Sabbath year, in the sabbatical year, they were to read the law during the Feast of Booths. Okay, which is in month 7. Okay, and so remember we talked about last week that now they read the Torah once every year, and then at the Feast of Booths, it's like the reset of that. We finish reading the Torah for the year, okay, and they have this big celebration, okay? But in biblical times, on year 7, you were at the Feast of Booths, you were to read the entire law to the people. Okay, we talked about that last week as well. Okay, so that is the Sabbath year, every seventh year. Then, verse 8, you are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times, 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years. Okay, then you're to sound the ram's horn on Day of Atonement to start the year. Verse 10, you shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. So every 50th year was to be a year of jubilee. Verse 10, each of you shall return to his own property, each of you shall return to his family. So two big things mark jubilee year. All property goes back to its original owner. All slaves get freed and sent back to their families. Okay, so property back, slaves back. Year of Jubilee started with the trumpet blast on the Day of Atonement, which is the 10th day of the 7th month. Okay, and verse 10, this proclaimed release through the land. Okay, it can also, that word release can also be translated liberty. Okay, it proclaims liberty through the land to all its inhabitants. Okay, what's very ironic is Leviticus 25:10 is inscribed. Does anyone know where in America?
Supreme Court building?
No, it's on the Liberty Bell, right? That it proclaims liberty throughout the land. So Leviticus 25:10, there you go, Leviticus. On the Liberty Bell. Yes, and I don't think it's the whole verse. It doesn't say consecrate the 50th year. It just says proclaim liberty throughout the land. And I don't know exactly what translation, but it's because of liberty, right? So it's the Liberty Bell is proclaiming liberty through our land. Okay, which kind of doesn't fit, but that's all right. It's on our Liberty Bell. Okay. Jubilee is a transliteration of the word yobel, which means ram's horn, because the ram's horn sounded off the day, started off the year of Jubilee. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what it says in verse 9. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound a horn all through your land.
The 50th year kind of started at the end of the 49th year.
Okay, yes, but do you remember we talked about Israel has 4 New Year's?
Say again?
They have 4 New Year's days. Do you remember that? Yes, because the first of Nisan was a New Year day, but then Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the 7th month, right. And we said that's when how they count their years for the Sabbath year and the Jubilee year was from the 7th month. So on the 10th day of the 7th month, the year of Jubilee would have officially started. But yes, in our way of thinking, it would have been the end of the year.
That was the calendar that you
said. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so personal holiness must be carried out on the social plane, right, as well. So we're to take care of Israel is to take care of the poor and make sure that they did not take advantage of their fellow countrymen. Okay, so if they ever did follow Jubilee, which they didn't, we are pretty sure, they would have had 2 years where they did not plant crops. Year 49, because that would have been a seventh year, and year 50, So 2 years in a row, they would not have planted crops. Okay, which you can understand maybe why they didn't ever do it. Because that takes a lot of faith to say, I'm going to do nothing on my farm for 2 years in a row, and I expect God to just take care of me and for it to be all okay and for me not to be in financial ruin. Okay? That takes quite a bit of faith. Yes. Which we'll get there. He says it. He says, I'll take care of you, but they don't believe him. Okay? Verse 13 through 17 talks about quickly about purchase price. Okay? So verse 13, on this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale to your friend or your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Don't take advantage. Corresponding to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. So basically, when you bought land, what you were supposed to do is, it wasn't really a sale of land. It was a lease of the number of crops that they were going to get. Okay? So if you sold it on year one, right, you would sell it for 49 years of crops. That would be the price, right? If you sell it on year 40, you would sell it for 9 years of crops, okay, and that would be the purchase price because the land was coming back to you, right? I mean, if you sold your land on year 48, I don't know who would buy it because 49 is a fallow year, so nobody, but okay, it would be just 1 or 2 years of crops. Okay, because the land was supposed to come back to you on your 50. So did they do this either? Probably not. If they never did Jubilee, probably not. Okay? But the land was to come back to you on Jubilee. So they were not to take advantage of each other. Verse 18, you shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgment so as to carry them out, that you may live securely on the land. Then the land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, right, God knows, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. So God says, if you obey, in the sixth year, your crop will be so large that it's enough to last you 3 years. Okay? If you just trust me. So God promises that if you obey his law, he's going to provide for you 4 Sabbath and Jubilee years. Even 2 years in a row, he will provide enough food that you will be fine. One of my commentators said, the size of the harvest is determined by the timing and quantity of rain during the growing season. Both factors can change dramatically from 1 year to the next in Israel. So if you obey, God will send the perfect rain, the perfect amount of rain at the perfect time so that your harvest is just a bumper crop, right? And you will be fine. He will take care of you. Okay? And this is, again, a reminder that the provision of food does not depend on your labor. It's not how much you work. It is God. Right? God is the one that sends the rain or withholds the rain or sends the locusts or doesn't, you know. And so your food, your survival is dependent on God. Work is relative, for if needs are to be met in life, God must provide. And that's the same today. You know, I mean, we don't farm, most of us, right? And most of us who do, I mean, even those who do farm aren't really farming for their food. You know, they're not growing their own food. But it is still God who provides. It blesses our work or doesn't. I just have an example. My parents, they had some money invested in stocks, and they came back to the States, and they wanted to sell it so they could buy a house. And their investor was like, because everyone's stocks had, like, gone way down. And they're like, he's like, I don't know what happened, but you guys is, like, the only stocks that have gone up. And my parents didn't have, you know, financial savvy to put it here, put it there. But it's like God takes care of you, you know. He wanted them to have enough money, so their stocks went up when everyone else's went down. You know, they had nothing to do with it.
You could enter any job description.
Exactly. Exactly. God is going to take care of you or not, you know, or he wants you to go through a time, whatever. But God is the one in control. Yep. I mean, and we are still, you have to balance that out, right? Because you can't just sit on your hands and you are to still to work, but God is the one who ultimately provides. Okay. Okay, the next section, Leviticus 23 to 34, verse 23. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me. So this is the reason for all these laws. Okay, this is the rationale behind the whole chapter. God owns the land. He gave specific portions of land, or he will, right? Because at this time they're still in Sinai. But in the future, he is going to give specific portions of land to specific tribes and to specific families. It was never to permanently leave those tribes and families. Okay? The land never truly belonged to Israel to dispose of as they pleased. It always belonged to God. Israel was just a tenant on God's land. Okay? So they were not allowed to do with it what they wanted. They were just aliens and sojourners in Israel, okay? So they had to obey God's rules, or they were supposed to at least. Okay, 24 to 28, there are three ways your property can be returned to you. Okay, the first is going to be kinsman redeemer, redeems it. The second is if you somehow get enough money to buy your own land back. And the third is that it returns on Jubilee. So it's, we know that the kinsman redeemer did happen at least occasionally. And so it's possible that the seller also could buy their own land back. But we're pretty sure Jubilee never happened. Okay. So verse 24, it says, thus for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. So the rule was, if someone sells you their land, they can always come back and redeem it, and you cannot tell them no. So if they sold land to you and they somehow conjure up the money to buy it back, you, as the now new quote-unquote owner, you cannot refuse them. You can't say, no, I want to keep the land. You were supposed to say you had to let them redeem it. Whether that happened or not, I don't know. I mean, we know that at least the kinsman redeemer happens sometimes. Okay, verse 25, it says, if a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. So the first option is that your nearest kinsman or your close relative is under obligation to reclaim the land, okay, sold by his impoverished relative. Okay, and this is where we get the kinsman redeemer. Okay, examples, we have the example in Ruth, right, where Boaz is not the nearest relative to redeem the land, and so he has to go to the nearest relative, and the guy says, yeah, I'll take it. Oh, by the way, you have to take Ruth as wife. Just kidding. I don't want it. So that's Ruth 4. And then in Jeremiah 32, verse 7 to 14, there's another example of kinsman redeemer. Okay, the second option, verse 26, or in a case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years, and then he can buy it back. Okay? So, if the poor man somehow regains enough money, one of my commentators said most likely this would have been through an inheritance, if someone dies and then leaves him money, right? Because, I mean, selling land, that's a significant chunk of money. And so it's unlikely that a poor man is going to somehow earn enough money to buy his land back. But if someone dies and leaves him an inheritance, then he might have enough money to buy his land back. Okay, and then verse 27, then he shall calculate the year since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. Okay, so the idea there is you buy back the number of years until Jubilee. Okay, so if you sold it and there were 15 years to Jubilee, and then now someone died and there's only 5 more years to Jubilee, then you only have to buy back those 5 crops to get your land back. Because the idea is on Jubilee, you just get it back for free anyway. Okay. Then the last resort, verse 28, but if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, that he may return to his property. Okay, so as a last resort, on year of Jubilee, the land returns to original owner. In the year, sorry?
So he just gets his property back,
yes,
without any payment?
Yes. Because the way it was supposed to work, the payment that the buyer paid was to correspond to the number of years until Jubilee. Okay, so let's say the buyer buys it and there's only 10 more years to Jubilee. He's going to pay significantly less than if there are 49 years until Jubilee.
It's kind of like renting.
Yeah, it's you basically leased the land and paid for the number of crops that you were going to be able to harvest from it. So if you bought the land and there's only 2 years left till Jubilee, you probably paid not very much of anything. Okay, but if there are 40, theoretically, right? Remember, they didn't do this. Right. It was the way it was supposed to be. You know, so if there's only 5 more years till Jubilee, you don't pay that much. But if there's 49 years until the next Jubilee, because the last Jubilee just happened and the guy's something, you know, catastrophe strikes and is destitute.
The guy that sold the land, he has to work for the one that bought the land?
No, not necessarily. Right. So if I have land and I sell it to Joyce, now she has to pay me money. Right now I have money that I can then now theoretically support myself on. Okay. But I need that money now as opposed to wait until my crop comes in to get the money. Right. Because you'd have to wait for the harvest to come in. So if something happens and I need that money now and I am desperate, then I might have to sell my property and then get the money now. Okay, then we're going to talk about if you're so destitute that you have to sell yourself as a slave, okay? Because selling your property is like step one, and then selling yourself is like the last resort. I really have nothing, okay, and I have to sell myself as a slave. But theoretically, when I sold my land, it corresponded to the number of years. So the closer you are to Jubilee, the less and less you're paying for land, because you're really only paying for the crops you're going to get. Right, so you're not really buying out the land.
What happens if you buy the land and then you sell it to somebody else, so it's a second person known?
Great choice. I have
I'm
no
sorry.
Idea. No, great question. I mean, I thought about, okay, so God gave it to this specific family. Well, now they have 10 sons, right? Who gets, well, I suppose the oldest inherits the land, right? So I guess maybe it only goes to one, but I don't know. What about all the other people? What are they doing? You know, I mean, I feel like it could get really complicated.
No wonder they didn't do it.
Yeah. No wonder they didn't do it, but they should have. They were supposed to, you know, because that's what God said. And when they were in exile, the length of time they were in exile corresponded to the laws that they broke. So. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and maybe everyone just works for him, so the land stays. I don't know how that all worked, you know. But yeah, it gets complicated. So yeah. Okay, where were we? Okay, man, we're not gonna. I don't think we're good. Well, maybe we'll finish. Okay, let's go quickly. Just one place. Isaiah 63. Can someone read for me verse 16? Isaiah 63:16. Everyone's in the bathrooms now.
Though Abraham does not know us and Israel does not recognize us, you, O Lord, are our Father, our Redeemer from of old is your name.
Okay, so here it calls God our Father, and that word for Redeemer, Isaiah 63:16. Okay, that word for Redeemer is the same word in Kinsman Redeemer, to redeem the land. The Kinsman Redeemer was to redeem the land. That's that same word. Okay, and also in Isaiah 54:5, we won't turn there, that also calls God our Redeemer. So the idea is that on year of Jubilee, God redeems the land. God is your kinsman redeemer, and he buys back the land for everyone, even though he doesn't pay the seller anything. Okay, but that was the law. Either a kinsman redeemer does it, you can buy it back yourself, or year of Jubilee, God will do it for you. Okay, verse 29 through 34, this is what happens if you sell your house in a walled city. Okay, if you sold your house in a walled city, it's different. You as the seller have 1 year to buy it back. If you don't, then it permanently becomes the buyer's. Okay, verse 29. Likewise, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it is not brought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to its purchaser. Throughout his generations, it does not revert in the Jubilee. Okay, then verse 31, the house in the villages, however, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Jubilee. Okay, so the reason that it's there's a difference is that it was most likely that the houses in the walled cities fall outside the jurisdiction of family property. Okay, so God gives your family this property. Well, if you want, you can just decide to go live in the city. Okay, but that's, and then commute or whatever to work your property. But your house in the city then is not part of your family property. So if you sell it, then it just becomes somebody else's after a year if you can't buy it back. Okay, and it would not have, it was not critical for the economic survival of the family, the house in the city. What's critical for your economic survivor, your economic survival is your land that's outside the city. Okay, Levites, different. Verse 32, as for city of the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which they are possession. Does anyone have a guess why? Okay, good. They are the Levites. What'd you say, Joyce? That's all they own. Okay. Numbers 35, 1 through 8. The Levites were given 48 cities and their surrounding pasture lands. That's it. They did not get a land apportionment, and their 48 cities were to be throughout Israel, okay? So if they can permanently lose their house, they lose their inheritance. They have nowhere to go. There's nothing left for them, okay? And it says, if you look at verse 34, but pasture fields of their cities shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. So the Levites, they were allowed to sell their houses if they needed to. Okay, but those would theoretically revert on Jubilee, but the surrounding pasture lands they were not allowed to sell. Whether they obeyed it or not, who knows? But that was the law. Okay, that was how it was supposed to be. Okay, questions so far? I don't know if I'm going to finish. Okay, we'll try. Okay, verse 35 to 55. The last section is what happens if you sell yourself into slavery. Okay, verse 35. Now, in case of a countryman of yours who becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you. Okay, so first of all, that word countryman can be translated brother. Okay, so this could either be a Jew or literally your brother. Okay, it says with means with regard to you falter. He owes you money and he can't pay it. What do you do? Okay. You are to sustain him. Okay. You aren't to let him just starve to death in the hedgerows. So family fighting, hard feelings, or prejudice were not to stop you from helping the poor. Okay. You were to help the poor no matter how you felt about it. Okay. You weren't allowed to just let them starve. That goes along verse 36. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God that your countrymen may live with you. Verse 37. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. Okay. You are not allowed to charge other Jews interest. Okay. And Israel was the only nation that was like this. Every other nation, you were allowed to charge interest. Now, some nations had rules on how much you could charge and not, but none of them said you couldn't charge any. Okay, so if you made a loan, you were not to charge interest. And if you sold them food, you were not to make it a profit.
Only to the Israelites, right?
Yes, only to the Israelites. In Deuteronomy, it says they could charge interest if they made a loan to a Gentile. Okay. In Ezekiel, we don't have time, but Ezekiel 18, 10 to 13, charging interest is listed alongside sins like adultery and murder. Okay, so... Or adultery and robbing the poor and eating at pagan shrines. Okay. Charging interest is there too. Ezekiel 18, 10 to 13. Okay. You were not to sell food for a profit. This would help keep the poor from complete devastation. Okay. They were just to buy food at cost. Okay, verse 38. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. The land is God's. They were once slaves in Egypt, and God rescued them. So they need to have compassion on those among them who are poor and down and out. Okay, they are to remember what they once were. Okay, verse 39. If a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. Okay, we talked a lot about slave law in Exodus, if you remember. And it was more like, kind of like signing up for the military is our best example. Okay, there are certain things you have to do and it can be not fun. Right? But you do still have certain rights. You are not just a slave like we think of American slavery. Okay? So he would remain with you until redeemed at Jubilee. Okay? And they were not to be treated like slaves in Egypt. Okay, three times it says you shall not rule over him. If you look at verse 43, it says you shall not rule over him with severity, but you are to revere your God. Verse 46, but in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. And verse 53, like a man hired year by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. Okay, so they were not to be cruel and harsh to their slaves. They were still Jewish. They were still God's chosen people. Okay, so they were not to treat them like slaves. Now, verse 44 to 46, it says that you can get slaves from the pagan nations around you. Okay, verse 44, then too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they will have produced in your land, they may also become your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive as a possession. Okay? This rubs our modern sensibilities the wrong way. Okay, right? Because nobody should be saved. But if you think about it, when God sent them into the land, what were they to do with the people? Kill them. Okay, they were to wipe them out. So making them a slave would have actually been a mercy, a grace, okay, to not just kill them. And also, the idea too is that when God redeemed his people from Egyptian slavery, whose slaves did they become? God's slaves, right? They did not stop being slaves. They went from being Egypt slaves to God's slaves. Therefore, they cannot become anybody else's slaves because they are God's slaves and God's not selling them, okay? So the Israelites are God's slaves. It is unfitting, therefore, that an Israelite should be resold into slavery, especially to a foreigner, okay? But you're already God's slaves, so you can't be anyone else's slaves. So if you're at the end of your rope and you have to sell yourself into slavery, then one, you shouldn't be treated like a slave. You should be treated like a hired man. And two, you're a Jubilee. You should be released, okay? Even verse 47 says, now, if the means of a stranger or sojourner with you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemption rights after he has been sold. So, a lot of language. What that's saying is if you as a Jew become so poor that you need to sell yourself as a slave, right, and you sell yourself as a slave to a Gentile that is living in Israel, he still has to treat you like a hired man, and you have the right of redemption, meaning a kinsman redeemer can come and buy you back. You can, if somebody dies and leaves you inheritance, can buy yourself back, or he has to release you at your Jubilee as well, theoretically, right? Didn't happen, but theoretically. Okay, so even if a Jew became a slave of a Gentile, right, he should be treated like a hired man, and he still had all the rights of a Jew to be redeemed or to be released at Jubilee. Okay, foreigners living in Israel had to obey Israel's law. They could not mistreat a Jewish slave because the Jews had already been mistreated in Israel. I mean, even verse 53, like a man hired year by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. That's a Gentile. So even the Gentiles were not to rule over Jewish slaves with severity. And then verse 54, even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out in the year of Jubilee, he and his sons with him. For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants whom I brought up from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Okay? Israel, they're God's slaves. Therefore, they cannot truly be slaves of anyone else, another Jew or Gentile.
So, a stranger in the land that they make into a slave.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Because it says, verse 46, you may even bequeath them to your sons after you. Okay. So then they become, you know, passed down. Okay. Good. Questions? We did it. Good. All right. We will do 26 and probably 27 next week. So. All right. I'll pray and we'll